Welcome to the third episode in this podcast series on thought leadership and professional development organized by the IFOA. So we have Tom Philp as our guest today. Tom has a PhD in meteorology from the University of Reading and regularly speaks at industry and academic events on issues of climate risk and climate change. He is currently a research associate of the philosophy department at the London School of Economics. Tom previously held the position of senior manager in AXA XL's science function. His roles within that function included CAT model hazard evaluation, building views of natural peril risk, and developing applied science projects with academics and universities. In October 2020, he started his own company, Maximum Information. In today's episode, we will discuss a range of topics from NACAD modeling to research to challenges around data for emerging risks, but also discuss the work he has been doing around innovation. And joining us in today's discussion are my fellow IFOA volunteers, Samir Kishani, the chair of the GI board, and Tom Day, who's a member of the GI Research and Thought Leadership Committee. Welcome, Tom. Great to have you on this show.
Great to be here. Thanks for inviting me. Looking forward to a good chat.
Not a problem at all. And we know you're extremely busy with multiple engagements. So thank you for making time. I mean, the question that we've been sort of asking everyone on these sort of discussions is, how has the last 12, 13 months been for you, both personally and professionally?
It's strange, I think, is probably the most accurate answer. It's been, different. So, I mean, it's been different for lots of reasons, right? So for everybody, the natural answer is COVID and the disruption. But obviously, as you mentioned, in October, I left to start up my own venture. So that's been an interesting time to have jumped into that with both feet under lockdown. But I think one of the positive sides of it is that it's just allowed me the space to get my head down. And as I'm sure we'll touch on later on, a big part of what I saw in the opportunity for the venture is this innovation piece and this collaboration piece. And usually a lot of my work required me, training around, driving around, flying around to different places around the world to actually have these conversations with people. And one of the things that COVID has definitely done for the positive side has really allowed people to not necessarily have to be there in person. Obviously, much nicer to do it, but how normal it is now to jump on a call with anybody at any part of the world is fantastic. So making massive amounts of progress very quickly, potentially much quicker than I think we would have, or I would have if we were not under lockdown. So yeah, it's been good, a bit of a strain, but good fun.
Yeah, indeed. I think when at the start of the pandemic, like, video calls were a novelty. Now it's the norm.
Absolutely.
So can I just ask you, Tom, what prompted you to kind of, because you worked in the insurance industry for, a little while and were doing great stuff. And were you kind of surprised at how variable the research element was within insurance companies? And is that what prompted you to go out and on your own and do your own venture? I mean, what were your thoughts on that? What drove you to kind of move into doing your own thing and out of an insurance company?
It's a great question. And I think I sort of have to always clarify that I was not unhappy at all. I mean, I'll get a bit of background for this sort of progression, really, is that I joined the Catlin syndicate. Obviously, it then was bought by XL, which in turn was bought by AXA, so changed a lot over the time. But I joined Catlin in 2014. And originally, I'd come out of just finishing my PhD, and my research in the past, before my PhD even, was in hurricane research. And really, I'd always assumed that I was going to go through and stay in the real science side of things. When I finished the PhD, though, I think I was frustrated with a lot of things in science and academia. I think that the major thing was often a lack of attachment to real world problems. I think there's this classical statement about PhDs that more and more about less and less until you know everything about nothing. And it really felt like that with me. So I decided, well, one of the reasons for me doing the PhD and getting the funding to do the PhD was that it was risk related. It was European windstorm and extreme wind speeds related. So I was, for the funding to come through for me, I had to present at various risk conferences. And at those conferences, I met a few people in the insurance industry. And at the time, Catlin had recently appointed a chief science officer, set up a science research department, which largely hasn't been equaled, actually. There's similar teams, but still hasn't been equaled in the industry. But I met the guy that was leading that, And he effectively said that it might be a nice match for me to come in. We had a few more conversations. And eventually I just thought, well, it'll be a nice break from academia. At worst, it'll be a nice break. And what I did find, having made that leap, was just how many fascinating questions there are once you start really applying the scientific risk thinking into real world and applied risk thinking, and how much more complicated it gets, but I guess how much more interesting it gets as soon as you do make it more complicated. So I made the leap in October to my own venture, not in any way that I was tired of or anything of the work we're doing. Absolutely fascinating work at AXA XL, lots of great projects. But I think the major reason, really, I suppose there's two sides to the coin here. The first one is purely that one of the biggest challenges that I saw was how little, I guess peer review is probably the right word to use, but how little peer review exists, particularly around the cat risk space. So obviously cat modeling, having grown up in private industry really in the late 80s, early 90s, it doesn't exist in coherent places as a sort of whole holistic thing in many universities, if any. I think I'd probably hint at one that probably does it fully. But it means that there's often just not, the methods and tools and everything just aren't available in academia, and that they aren't available to critique. And that always became a huge frustration for me, because at some point you'd realize that some process wasn't, effectively, that it hadn't been peer reviewed in a sense that you couldn't quantify the value of making something more complex or changing one method to another. And really, I think a big reason for me was to try and get that a lot of those questions out in the open for real scrutiny from academia. I think the other side of the coin, as I was sort of hinting at, is that, well, when you start doing that, and as I mentioned, the number of questions is just so massive in insurance, because obviously you're attaching not just science, but it goes through engineering with obviously your vulnerability pieces and your exposure stuff, and then you're onto your economic modeling. But really, we're sort of at a tipping point in the market, in the climate risk space particularly. And it's largely, obviously, for good reason, societal pressure, meaning that regulators and shareholders putting pressure on insurers to really communicate what climate change is going to mean to them and how they're trying to respond to the climate challenge. And that's very difficult in using the traditional cat models that are there, that effectively are there for present day risk management and don't necessarily give you the nice outputs that allow for easy narratives to be formed. And even for looking at future risk and how things might evolve, they don't give you easy tools yet to do that. Obviously, lots of people are working on that, but it felt like it was a nice opportunity that there were combination of that peer review challenge plus the climate change one that was opening up more and more questions, and that really allowed me or prompted me to think, okay, we need to make the leap. So it was probably a combination of the two.
Yeah, because I find it quite smart. I mean, you mentioned Catlin and AXA XL, and I would suggest that that's a company that takes it very seriously and had put a lot of energy and resource into that. But I find it so surprising sometimes that there is such variability, you know, between insurance companies as to how much they put into it, considering what their exposures are. And like I said, it just surprised me when I come across these companies, and some have teams of researchers and cat modelers and analysts and all that, and others have two guys or two gals sitting in the corner just loading stuff into RMS or AIR or whatever.
And I think it's such a great point. And I think one of the things that would surprise people is that, having known, obviously I was part of this science function, but we overlapped very strongly with the cat model team. Yeah. But sometimes you'll find that there is a sort of science function in other insurers, but it is part of the cat model team. There just isn't an explicit distinction between them. But what's really interesting is that I agree with you. There are some companies that seem to just have almost nothing. Everything is almost completely light touch using directly cat model output. And others have massive amounts of expertise that not only, I guess, edit the models at right at their core, but they build their own as well. But I think on that peer review point, not just of the scientific methods and everything, what's really fascinating is there just doesn't seem to be a peer review of that relative amount of investment in those teams. Yeah. I think that would be really valuable, because I think a lot of people in the market, or a lot of companies in the market, would realize that they might actually be quite far behind the rest of the market in terms of how other people are thinking about managing the risk there.
Yeah, and I think to bring it back to the actuarial point, I think actuaries traditionally have come through kind of reserving background and are involved in pricing and capital. And I think increasingly, find themselves having to be responsible for example, the external model to the extent that it forms a part of the capital model or elements of risk management and validation. And I think not all actuaries are comfortable doing that because it's not something as simple as saying, oh, well, you're an actuary, you're responsible for the capital model, so you can then go and peer review what the cap models are telling you or what the aggregations managers are saying. It's quite an uncomfortable position, I think, and particularly when you're talking about such huge topics like climate change or trying to understand your own view of risk. So it may be something relevant for our actuarial listeners in particular out there.
Yeah, and then I remember, sort of, I think Tom presented one of the hot topics, the 2017 Gyra, I think the one in Dublin, and I think you're talking about the hurricanes in 2017. But one of the things that kind of resonated with me back then was kind of, you talked about the sort of the inability to bridge the gap between academia and real life. And it's kind of, there are some cases where vendor models are used, licenses are kind of, if those are all licensed products and not available to the academia. And in some cases, as you mentioned, that there are so many questions, interesting questions. And I'm sure if we kind of connected better with academics, there would be a lot of answers to those questions. Do you think things have changed in the last 4 years?
Yeah, massively changed, definitely for the better. I think there's been a few different reasons for that. I think on the one hand, I mean, you can look back to say, as I mentioned, the funding in my PhD required me to go and present at risk conferences. Those type of initiatives that try and push you towards this impact, that's been happening for a long time in academia. Obviously, there's still a huge space and a need for blue sky research, but I think it's great that there's so much funding pushed towards impact now. So people really have to show how it's attaching to the real world. But yeah, I think there's another side of it where industry is really looking at itself and trying to reach out as well. So there are effectively bridges trying to be built from both sides. And I'm just seeing more and more people actually making the leap back and forth actively, really, between industry and academia. And I think one of the things that, you know, I would say is most positive is that, so it was 7 years ago that I joined the industry effectively, or just over 7 years ago. I think when I first joined, it was strange, but there were actually a fair few pockets of insurers or insurance-related private companies that still were strongly questioning the climate change science effectively. So not necessarily, obviously, the very complex things when we get to risk, but just the fundamentals of it. I won't mention who, but I think I even went to a conference that was organized in the city that was effectively an anti-climate change conference. It was, these are the reasons climate change doesn't exist. I mean, if you think about that happening in the present day, it couldn't, right? It just absolutely, we've tipped completely over the other way. I mean, that absolutely was in the minority back in 2014, but it just wouldn't exist today. And I think there was another side of it as well. I do think 4 years is an interesting thing you gave there, because I think it was approximately that time. The EU had a big Copernicus climate change service drive in about between 2015, 2017, they had a big sector engagement thing. And I led the insurance sector engagement part of that. And what was interesting is that it was really new for a lot of risk managers in the industry. It was really new to think about the concept that, well, we price risk on an annual basis, therefore we can adjust for climate change at any point. But that doesn't really get at those key questions about protecting society, protecting clients, and then business strategies longer term. And so we're teasing those out, that really felt like we were just starting that conversation. But what's interesting is that it did feel that between that period, it did feel like you were still struggling to get attachment at the highest levels. But I couldn't tell you why or what it was that has caused the big flip the other way. I mean, it could be the cat events we've seen, 2017, 2018, the hurricanes you mentioned, and wildfires, California. It could have made people realize. But it seems now that rather than me going out and starting that conversation, it's actually people coming to me in the last few years and trying to start that. I think there's some interesting things there that we have to really be careful about approaching, when effectively, to me, it's almost like a pendulum was swinging. And I was on the climate science side of the pendulum, and the risk managers were maybe over the other. And the right answer lies somewhere between us about how to get the right route forward. Sometimes it often feels now that sometimes the pendulum has swung the other way. Climate change is thrown out there almost as a reason that everything has got worse or all the losses have got worse in the last few years. And obviously it's not the case. It's likely to be a reason and definitely a compounding part of the compounding reasons, but it isn't obvious often a single reason. And so there's that need to get the right balance is very difficult when you're effectively have come from the other side pushing towards, we need to think about this more. And then you suddenly get the everybody coming through the door saying, okay, we're ready to think about it more and we've got to change all these. And it's like, okay, we now need to think about it less or in a bit more balanced way. It's a really fascinating place to be at the moment, but I agree. Around 4 years ago was about that flip change when everything got very serious. Yeah.
Yeah, I think you sort of made an interesting point. So, of course, like hurricanes and wildfire, et cetera, probably made people think more about cat modeling. But like the pendulum example, in the mid-noughties, people were talking about clustering and then it kind of went away from people's sort of interest and agenda. But I think and I hope like climate change awareness is going to sort of make people think, make it part of their BAU thinking process and should be there to stay, I guess. Sorry, Samir.
No, I was just going to say, what's been interesting about the last 12 months, I think, in particular, is I was a bit worried to sort of, I guess, beginning of last year, maybe the year before, people were starting to talk about the insurance market hardening again and the fact that, oh, well, we're going to make money. And I was a bit worried we might take our eye off the ball because it was the good times. And then COVID happened. All the insurers were poised. You'd say, OK, well, we're going to have another hard market. We just got to get through this COVID period. But actually, a lot of those losses now, particularly with regards to the FCA test case and everything, we kind of people are getting a handle of what those liabilities are likely to be. But it's actually the unexpected natural catastrophe against events that, again, have hurt people. And it has meant that now not only are people conscious of these kinds of events and are not taking the eye off the ball, but they're also thinking about man-made catastrophes and pandemics and all that. So actually, suddenly you've got a real interest and incentive to look at disaster modelling across the whole piece, I think, which has given it even more impetus, I would say, over the last 12 months. But
and do you think, sorry, Tom, were you going to say something? Tom Day. Sorry, did I interrupt you?
I'm enjoying what's going on. If something occurs to me, one thing actually thinking about it that does occur to me, which is that obviously not all companies, like we were saying, depending on how large or small they are going to feel able to set up a science function specifically. And I guess the question that's on my mind is to what extent can people who are not specialists in catastrophe modeling still nevertheless, are there key sort of validation procedures or things that they could improve that, I mean, you've seen how it works from inside AXA XL, things that actuarial departments are not currently doing that they could do better without necessarily going the whole hog and having a science department?
Yeah, I think it's a really, another great question. And I think there's no easy answer, right? So I really hope that what the venture that I've got going, there's a private split and an innovation, a not-for-profit split. And that's a really important part of this, where in the same sense if we need everything out there for peer review, I think we need a lot of this questioning and this breakdown between what you would call the more scientific side of catastrophe modeling and the actuarial side of it. We need that more open because I think the lines of discussion and dialogue are very difficult to, I guess, progress. So what I was lucky at AXA XL, we were sat within the actuarial function. We had a couple of actuaries sat with us. So there was always that dialogue ongoing, but it did take months and years even to really fully appreciate how we were talking and thinking through that risk. And I think, so on the one side, one of the pillars that I'm trying to build on the not-for-profit is this, there's a huge amount, if you imagine outside of the actuarial community, there's a huge amount of cat modelers in the market at every insurer, broker, that are just in exactly the same way you described there, Tom, exactly the same feeling of, we just want to help. We would like to forward this conversation using our knowledge of the cat models and implementation of the cat models. And so myself and another ex-PhD from Reading, who's also in the industry, Richard Dixon, we started a climate risk, a cat modeling group, really, effectively, to think about how we would start trying to I guess, translate the science and then think about the appropriate implementations in cat models. We thought it would be a group where we'd send out to a few people, key cat modelers that have a scientific interest in the market, and we'd probably get a group of 10 or so people that would just be really happy to get on board. And within a couple of months, we're at 90 people and counting now. And it feels like if we did exactly the same for the actuarial community, an attachment to pricing models, probably, and something like that, we'd have I think it would be a different order of magnitude of really interested actuaries that would come to the table. Yeah, I mean, I've got a number of questions that I'd love to throw at the actuarial community to think about. Like, one of the reasons, say, like Maximum Information is the name of my venture. The reasoning for that is it is quite probabilistic in nature as well. Fundamentally, it's this questioning of what is probability. Does probability exist? I mean, I'm very happy to have that conversation with you guys today, or equally, anybody wants to get in touch with me about that and to debate it with me, I'd be fascinated.
So please feel free to ask some of the questions. But like, does probability exist is kind of, I think most of us will have existential crisis.
Well, exactly, right? I think this is, I know the actuarial community would love this. I'm sure loads of people in the actuarial community would disagree with me as well, or maybe not disagree with me once I qualify it, but I'm sure there'd be a number of points of debate. Tom, I know you would debate all this day and night. So, but I'll throw out some of the sort of the ideas of it, and then we can see where we go. But so Maximum Information, that concept or that name comes from some debates that I used to read essays between Owen Schrodinger and Niels Bohr. Once effectively quantum theory was discovered and this classical Newtonian physics was upended. So this idea that unambiguous deterministic physics, where you got precise things and perfect estimates of the reality of the state of the world, just completely collapsed. And it ends up being that actually there is a level of physics that has to be probabilistic. You get to that Schrodinger's cat example. You can't know that if the cat is alive or dead until you observe it. And so you can only deal with things probabilistically. Effectively, that is of no surprise to any actuary. That, I mean, that's your bread and butter, right? Everything is probabilistic, and that's the world you want to deal with. But what was in that sort of catastrophe and climate risk world, I think a couple of important additions to that type of thinking have very important implications. So the first one is that if you take the reality, and I'll come back to it, this concept that probability does not exist. So I think that was actually a statement made by an actuary back in the day. This is, I think, a 1920s paper by Bruno De Finetti. And it was effectively, he was arguing that there is no such thing as objective probability. Effectively, you have to, at whatever point, put your beliefs in. So I think the simple example that they use in that paper is effectively, if you have a simple six-sided die, a classicist would look at it and effectively say there's six possible outcomes and the symmetry of the die gives you your probability. But a frequentist would look for empirical evidence. And immediately you input that somebody could have a different belief and then come to a different answer. And obviously a subjectivist is the final part of that they would go, well, no, some of these things might hold in certain situations. But effectively, there's always a level of subjectivity. I think and this is one of the conversations I used to have with some of our actuaries. I think for a lot of like attritional insurance where you've got a lot of data, in the same way that casino, roulette wheel, everything, it doesn't matter if you're classical or you're frequentist, you get the same answer as long as you've, you know, thought about it properly. But the reality is, when you then combine that situation with Ed Lorenz, right? So I'm going to jump to another. So this is Ed Lorenz, the sort of grandfather of chaos theory. So 1950s, MIT, effectively it's the butterfly effect stuff. So he was studying dynamical systems systems that were very nonlinear. So just by varying initial conditions of the model runs you used would lead to chaotically different states. And that's what effectively that butterfly effect thing is. A flap of a butterfly's wing could cause a hurricane, and not modeling it, you'd miss it. But I think ultimately, when you take those things all together, right, there's just there's no non-subjective way to collapse probabilities when you think about the cat model system, particularly when you've got that lack of data and this very nonlinear system underlying it. And I think that reality means that we have to think of something else, really. I think the crux of the point, I guess, I'm arguing, and I'd love to debate it, is I sort of believe that while I believe that's the case, a lot of the probabilistic stuff that's done in the cat model space still relies on law of large numbers collapsing of the probability distributions. So while there might be very complex ways to do it, and people can point to like Bayesian methods and everything used in lots of different cat model techniques, it still is subjective, and it still isn't going to be, particularly certain to me when you know that there's just so little data that you're collapsing with. So to me, it sort of leads to this very important point that actually explicit decision theory is something that we really need in the cat risk space. And I just don't think is there. I think without it, the best way that I try and put this when I do end up in debates, but to actuaries, is if you were CEO of a very niche cat risk reinsurer, and then in the other scenario, you're a CEO of a personal lines, home and car direct insurer, do you think that the same sort of pricing and capital management outputs of a cat model when it comes to sort of the hurricane risk, and you understand how wide that uncertainty band is, do you think the same estimates should hold for each one? And I think if you were to understand how wide that band can be, I would probably argue no. You need some level of what the decision means to you, at what point is the return period curve or EP curve actually important to you before you start thinking about collapsing the uncertainty. And I think that's, to me, that's been missing from the catastrophe model repertoire, I guess. Ultimately, at the moment, any of the major vendors, they've pre-collapsed the uncertainty. They've obviously captured it, but they've pre-collapsed it for you. And then it's up to actuaries to build it back in largely and try and work through things there. But it becomes very difficult to unpick. So that actually, and then you can add these even further things on when, as you've already mentioned there, they are effectively private protected models. You can't see through them properly. So you can't even understand uncertainty fully, even if you were to have full control of the model, which we also don't. So you end up, I think, with this need for decision theory. And that's where effectively a lot of my work in recent years has gone. I started off, I think, in science for projects, trying to build, I guess, hurricane focused questions and developing very targeted improvements in the stochastic modeling and everything. But more recently, I've ended up questioning, it's actually philosophy of science, it feels like, philosophy of probability, philosophy of effectively that. Again, I don't think that's there, but needs to be another thing that's, I guess, teased out a bit more. But no, I'm always fascinated to hear what actuaries have to say, because they always have very good, well-informed, but often different opinions to reaction to that. So, happy to take any thoughts if any of you have got them.
Well, I mean, just thinking that through, I suppose that the first is that very often licensing more than one model is expensive. Licensing one model is expensive. So in terms of sort of getting a handle on how much uncertainty we're talking about, depending on what possible plausible models you could choose, that can be quite tricky. But then even once you've done that, I suppose that when you try and translate that into a business decision, you can get pulled in two directions. One is that if you're sort of saying, well, our central idea is that the 1 in 200 is about this, but it could be 20, 50% more than that, you know, are we actually saying we should hold that much extra capital or declare our solvency ratio that much lower? On the other hand, there might be somebody else in the company who thinks that if there's that much uncertainty about it, could we not take advantage of the situation the other way? And it's very often in somebody's sort of commercial interest to use whatever uncertainty is available to report a higher solvency ratio or whatever it may be. I mean, obviously, in the long term, we would have concerns about what that might lead to. But in the short term, it can make everyone happy.
Absolutely. So, yeah, I think there's so many things with it, even within that I'd like to get into. But like one of the things that let's go into the model blending side of that. Right. So that was always something that was such a topical question for me as we on the particularly the hurricane side. And it's going to become more and more topical for everybody. But as climate change has its impacts and we have to think about looking forward and all of that. But even then, back in 2015 or so, one of the first big projects I did about implementation of North Atlantic hurricane risk was right around a time where, if you guys are aware of it, there's this effectively warm and cool phase of the Atlantic. It's the Atlantic multi-decadal oscillation. There's questions whether it even exists. There's lots of science that debates whether it exists or not, but it's very uncertain if it does exist. At that point, it seemed to be in a flipping phase. This is like a 20 to 30 year period, and it seemed to be flipping. If you used the Colorado State University's measure of it, it had flipped to a cool phase. But if you used NOAA's official phase of it. It was still in its warm phase. And so there were a couple of model vendors that had differing views depending on the state of the AMO. And it led to very different, like I'm talking multiple tens of percent different EP curves if you're using one or the other. And what was really fascinating to me then was I think a lot of the market does try and look at multi-models there and ignore those scientific questions behind. But what was really fascinating to me was that the two states aren't, then there's no average state there, right? So the average of those models was definitely wrong. So you've either got one state on the top or one state at the bottom. The middle state probably doesn't exist and can't exist. So by taking the average, you're only wrong. It might mean that still might be the best answer for you from a business perspective, but that would have to be played out. But scientifically speaking, you're one of these is right, one of these is wrong ultimately. And I think some of those really fascinating model blending questions have never really been unpicked properly either. And I know that, again, if some of those scientific way of thinking were put to actuaries, I think you guys would have your own views on how to appropriately deal with that. But yeah, so that was one of them. I think there was something in the second part of what you said, Tom, climate risk and uncertainty. I think one of the things that I've really struggled with is communicating to society. So obviously, climate change is a huge challenge for society, and it's going to impact those people that struggle with resilience in the present day are going to feel the effects of it disproportionately. It's going to cause a lot of loss of life, a lot of economic damage, particularly in those regions. But there's a really unsavory reality for the insurance industry that without uncertainty, we don't have a business. There's no industry without uncertainty, and there's no industry without risk. So there's a really fascinating climate change topic to debate here where often, while it's quite certain that we know that temperatures are increasing, global average temperatures and things like that, it's very simple to say those things about just the generic climate. When we're looking at extreme weather events, often, most often, the uncertainty band spans the zero line, particularly when we're looking at the spatial scales that we write business at. And so what you could often say is that the hazard may not be growing, but the uncertainty almost certainly is. And then I think it sort of comes full circle back to the decision theory need or need for at least explicit decision theory and tracing how you're making those decisions. Because ultimately, I think there's a sort of future where that, as I said, the CEO of that sort of niche cat risk reinsurer, there's more of a business plan. There's more of a reason to get into the market with climate change. But the personal lines, home insurance, somebody that doesn't want volatility, there's less of a reason to get involved in some of this cat risk exposed business. And that's a really difficult thing. I think to actuaries, you guys would all understand that. But trying to communicate that really unsavory point, that climate change for the industry has the potential to increase opportunity almost, is really difficult, but it can't be ignored, right? And I actually think it is being ignored by a lot in the market. Effectively, it's this assumption that climate change equals increased risk, increased losses. Mm-hmm. And it just may not be that. But yeah, I mean, anyway, to try and blow open that question would be brilliant.
I think one of the things that we certainly struggle with in the market is the winner's curse, isn't it? The person who wins the insurance contract is going to be the person who puts the lower estimate on the climate risk. Mm-hmm. And in the short term, it's going to be very possible, very difficult to prove that person wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's interesting what you say about cat models as well, just generally speaking, because I think they're a bit of a gift and a curse. Yeah? And where the companies have fully understood them, because as you say, it takes the decision piece away, or has probably made us a bit over-reliant on what's behind or what's underneath the box. And I mean, I don't know, what I quite like about what Lloyd's are doing, for example, is saying that, well, actually, unless you pick apart your model and you really understand it, then you can't have capacity and you can't go into these areas, which I think has been one of the better developments that they've put forward over the last few years. Because I think there was, we're going back 4 or 5 years, maybe not in the larger company, but certainly in the medium and smaller size companies, just this thing that, okay, well, we'll just plug it into our capital model. We kind of understand it. We've done a bit of validation, but we don't really take those beginning to end decisions all the way through the process.
Yeah. And I think you mentioned that, yeah, uncertainty is important to the insurance sector. And I think over decades, we've kind of proved that the industry is very resilient. And I think the ability to kind of measure or at least make an attempt to measure that uncertainty probably can lead to opportunities. And I think whether it's regulatory pressure or something else, I think we have in recent times kind of focused a lot on the 99.5, that magic number, and kind of ignored other parts of the distribution. And I think that is quite important as well.
But I think the insurance industry will always try and find a way to monetize something, right? Look at the amount of companies that are coming out with pandemic type products, right? So I think maybe it's going back to your point earlier, Tom, about we've been slow to react, but now people are starting to take climate change seriously, think about how they model it, think about how they capture the risk. And when they get to a point where they feel like they're beginning to get a handle on it, maybe you'll see a proliferation of products come out to try and take advantage of it.
I was certainly going to say, I'm just turning over in my mind some of the things that we said earlier, because I think earlier, Tom, you talked about decision theory and talked about how, given an uncertain outcome, you translate that into a decision for the business. And I feel like that's something that I know very little about, that actually the great majority of what I do centers around providing one view of risk and then embedding that, making decisions based on that, which is one of the reasons why it's so hard, why when the CAT models change. I mean, I think that there was a big example of this when we moved sort of towards the beginning of the 2010s, some of the CAT models suddenly got quite a lot heavier in the tail, and suddenly everyone was trying to purchase an extra top layer of reinsurance for their extra CAT risk. And so, yeah, I guess it's the whole thing about how you translate an uncertainty into a business decision. I feel like I know practically nothing about that, and I don't even know where I'd go to start learning about it.
Well, yeah. The funny thing is, right, I only found out a couple of years ago. So you've got obviously the major vendors, and I thought they were quite pure and academic and something in their approach, but I don't know, maybe at one of these conferences, someone was telling me that, there is political pressure on some of the models and some of the regions and areas. And I was thinking, oh my goodness, I didn't even think about that. And to your point, Tom, now I question actually, why has the tail got heavier? Is that actually based on some sort of evidence? What is the decision process? I can't even get a handle of that.
Exactly. So it's
a very interesting point you raise, actually.
Yeah, no, I think that's it. I'm making it explicit. But Tom, yeah, I mean, that was something that happened to me, right? It was basically, we were investing all this time trying to unpick the science or make the science more complex, more realistic, I suppose, is what we're aiming for always. But it got to a point where it's like, I'm trying to implement this, but I have no concept whether this is adding value or not. It just might not be adding anything, but we can't quantify it. And it just led me to this point where I'm just like, I'm out. I can't do it. There's no value to my life at the moment. So while I'd suddenly got like attachment to the real world, I'm suddenly like completely without value again. And I think I almost, you gave up everything. And I was like, no, come on. Like, how do people make climate policy decisions? They're relying on very uncertain models then. How are decisions made? And ultimately that led me through just sifting through literature at that point, led me to some academics at LSE who feed into or comment on the IPCC decision making, so the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, their decision process for how to implement policy action as a result of the climate science. And effectively, I just, after reading a load of their papers and just loving it, really, because they really got at the heart of that question, how to collapse the uncertainty if you're not just going to rely on averages of your probability distribution. It effectively just led me to asking them directly, have you thought about trying to do this in catastrophe modeling? And they actually both said, we tried to, but we don't have access to CAT models. And so it ended up like with me over the course of a few years, getting them access to CAT models. It culminated in a big paper. It was published in 2020. But effectively what we did there was create a toy hurricane model, basically, completely disconnected from reality, but just like looking at landfalling probabilities in Florida and having 10 different, an ensemble of 10 models, and then how you would ingest a decision maker's attitude to volatility, attitude to risk, basically, plus the stakes of the decision. So those two key things, you would add them in to the scientific uncertainty. Effectively, you would coarse grain the models into bins, and effectively, depending on how much certainty you needed, you'd start jumping up the level of the modeling. So you'd end up maybe 1 inch, going back to the CEO thing, a niche cat risk reinsurer might not need much certainty because they're actually seeking the risk, so they can price it at the average level. But somebody that doesn't want that wants to price it much higher. But what's really interesting to me is that personally, I've seen or certainly heard of people loading cat models because of uncertainty, but completely without any scientific basis, I guess. And ultimately, what I think they're doing is it's a very good thing for them to be doing it, right? They are rethinking in the same way that I was doing it, I guess, with scientific transparency. They're doing it with just what they clearly think and feel about the model, but are trying to get it. And I think one of the nice things about getting that decision theory side is it really shows you and gives you a reason for quantifying as objectively as possible, but with your subjective basis, I guess, how much you should be loading and how much you just don't need to load, I guess.
Okay. We can include a link to the LSE research in the podcast.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Great. We can sort of continue chatting about it for hours, but I think keeping an eye on the time. Samir, your last question to Tom.
Well, I was gonna suggest, Adaraj, if Tom doesn't know, or if he does know much about the working party that we have under Gürtel, and if you just wanted to spend a minute or two telling him about it, and then Tom maybe giving us some ideas as to future areas of focus, is that as a suggestion?
Absolutely, I think that's a great suggestion. We'll definitely do that. And Tom Day, one last question for Tom.
I'm just itching to get to look at this LSE research. I mean, I think what you highlighted, this is not going to end up being a question, possibly more of a comment, but I think what you highlighted about feeling that the more attached to reality, the sort of more it feels like you're nowhere in a sense. I mean, this is the feeling I think a lot of actuaries have a lot of the time, dealing with a lot of the time. And the idea that there's potentially a way out of this through possibly the decision theory that you've mentioned or other ways like that, I think, is for me the most important thing to come out of this.
Given that neither of us asked you a question, I will ask you a question. So do you think the time has come, Tom, to, you know, in the same way that we have an Institute of Actuaries, given the importance now of catastrophe modelling and all the things that we talked about, do you think the time has come for there to become an institute of aggregation or catastrophe modellers or whatever you want to call it? What do you think about the future there?
Yeah, 100%. And I guess, as we mentioned earlier, I think it's already starting. They're already in place. So conversations going on across London market, worldwide. Obviously, US has the International Society for Cat Managers, and they have their presentations at the RAA every year. So I feel like that's just going to snowball and snowball. I agree with you. It needs to be its own institute. But I guess, yeah, coming back to our way back original point, just one of the biggest things for me is that actuarial science has, you know, such a storied history. I'm obsessed with it, frankly, like having not known about it when I was in science. But you look at like Edmund Halley, one of the preeminent scientists of the world, being one of the best creating, I think, what was it, from his studies of mortality in the 1600s, it was the first life insurance tables or whatever that he created. This is Halley's Comet guy. So yeah, really fascinating history, but hugely storied and centuries old, right? And lots of literature, scientific, effectively peer-reviewed literature that comes along with that, just hasn't existed with cat modeling. So I definitely think that this Institute of Cat Modelers needs to be there. But at the same time, this much more needs to be thought through. What's the right place for peer review? Where is the journal going to be? Where it's going to sit? And why hasn't that really been picked up by the academic community as a whole yet? And where is it going to sit? I'm frustrated with that, I suppose. But at the same time, I'm really positive and I have a lot of hope given what I see around the world at the moment. Huge amount of people talking about this and trying to get collaboration between lots of different sectors to try and overcome this problem.
Sounds like a pitch to be the first president, I think.
With you three behind me, maybe I've got a chance.
And I think, Samir, to your point, I mean, I was thinking precisely that when Tom mentioned about peer reviews, because as part of the Institute, we have to maintain certain actuarial standards and get work peer reviewed before publishing it, et cetera, et cetera. So, yes, probably there's a point to that. But sort of my sort of last sort of question would be kind of just sort of to round off this conversation. And I was reading through the page on your website, Maximum Information. And I think one of the things, and You covered it in the discussion as well. One of the things is kind of transparency with models thinking to kind of expanding the horizon, really. So getting the actuaries, the underwriters, the risk managers think about cap modeling, as well as kind of cap modelers understanding what goes on in the sort of risk management space or actuarial profession. So what does this kind of future look like, or how does kind of maximum information fit in?
Yeah, okay, great question. Yeah, I don't know if I could do that very quickly, but no, one thing I'll really quickly focus on is that transparency issue in that model world stuff. I think there's a really important question that needs to be posed. Can any model be truly useful if it's not fully transparent? Obviously, there is an assumption that it is in the industry, because if there weren't that assumption, we wouldn't be able to use private model vendors. I think that there is a good argument to be made that they are useful in some sense, but they're not maximally useful. And I think there's been a push in recent years. I mean, just in the last couple of weeks, I've seen lots of headlines about the amount of funding from the industry to go towards the OASIS loss modeling framework. So the open source loss modeling framework to, you know, effectively have plug and play different hazards, vulnerability pieces, and ultimately aim for transparent modeling. I feel like that, again, snowballing in its potential uses. And a lot of sectors, the aid government sector, are very keen on it as well. The big transparency is key. Effectively, what I see is that I see maximum information being somewhere that sits in between something like a venture like OASIS, but also facilitating the sort of transition, I would say, of the private model vendors towards something that's more transparent. So effectively, maximum information to sit there as a translator. I think there's a big hole in the market for that type of thing, helping to make the models transparent in the ways that are necessary for people to use them appropriately. Yeah, I think that's the big area of opportunity. And I think there's a big opportunity there, private side, but at least as importantly for me, it's the translation of all of that to academia. So we start this real flow back and forth of all of the potential critique you could get and all of the exciting expertise that you would get in putting to that.
Perfect. Thank you very much, Tom. It was a pleasure talking to you. And to the listeners, so there will be a link on the IFOA LinkedIn page to this podcast if you've not subscribed already. And we will also share a link to the paper that Tom was talking about on the page. And just write in the comment section whether you're a classical or a frequentist. And yeah, we can have further debate on this. And we will make sure that we tag Tom in our LinkedIn post so that you can ask him any questions.
And a plug for the working party as well, Adirash.
Indeed, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tom.
Fantastic. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it. Good debate. Bye.